This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are extremely privileged to have with us as a guest for the next hour, Vincent Bugliosi. Vincent, welcome to the program.
Happy to be on the show, David. Thank you.
We are thrilled to finally have your voice on our internet airwaves. This is our third attempt to make this show happen. We messed up the scheduling once, and then we had a wildfire hit the studio the second time. And it may take more perseverance than this to accomplish what we're after here, which is putting the president or the former president behind bars for murder. Vince Bugliosi is the author of The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Let's talk about the basic premise. Who has the president murdered, and how might we convict him for it?
Okay, David, in my book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, I present evidence that proves, in my opinion and the opinion of many people who have read the book, beyond all reasonable doubt, that George Bush took this nation to war in Iraq on a lie, under false pretenses, and therefore, under the law, he is guilty of murder for the deaths of over 4,000 young American soldiers who have died so far in Iraq fighting his war. One of the interesting things, I think, David, is that although literally billions of very harsh, extremely condemnatory words have been said and written about George Bush in the last 7 years, none of which, by the way, he could possibly care less about. So the words are virtually meaningless. Up to now, other than talk, no one has done anything at all to George Bush. No impeachment, not even an investigation of him, nothing. He's gotten away scot-free so far. But in my book, I put together a legal case against Bush that could result in his being prosecuted for first-degree murder in an American courtroom after he leaves the presidency. He's got temporary immunity right now. I set forth the legal architecture for the case against Bush, the overwhelming evidence of his guilt, and the jurisdiction to prosecute him. And I say that if justice means anything in America, and if we're not going to forget about these 4,000 young American soldiers who came back from Bush's war in a box, I say we have no choice but to bring murder charges against the son of privilege from Crawford, Texas. I hope, David, we'll have time on the show to talk about some of the irrefutable evidence I have against Bush, evidence that I do not think he could possibly get around at any trial of him. Also, although it doesn't deal with the issue of whether he's guilty or not guilty, I'd like to talk about how George Bush has comported himself throughout the hell on earth he created in Iraq, having a lot of fun and enjoying himself throughout the entire period of the war. Another thing I'd like to talk about in depth, if we have the time, is the story behind the story of my book, that for the first time, David, with any of my books in my 30-year career as a writer, this book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, has been completely blacked out by the mainstream national media, who are absolutely apparently terrified of talking about the subject of this book. But as you may or may not know, the book has already become a New York Times bestseller by word of mouth and people like you, David, who are having me on your show.
Well, we should continue that and make it a record bestseller, and people can go to your website, correct me if I'm wrong, prosecutionofbush.com, and get the book, or get it at a bookstore, or get it at Amazon.com or Powell's, etc. But there are millions of people who are eager to talk about this, and I'm going to tell them how to get in on this conversation during the next hour. Anybody can call in toll-free in the U.S. or Canada, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. Or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and go to the chat room and text me your questions, and I will direct them to Vince Bugliosi, who is not just an incredible author, but a talented prosecutor with an outstanding record of past prosecutions, so he knows what he's talking about. I'd like to talk about the evidence, but I think what's new and what's going to excite people the most is this idea of actually putting this evidence to some use, because many of us have spent years dwelling over the piles of smoking guns, and nobody until you, as far as I know, came up with this idea. And so if you could explain to us how this works, because in your book you go through something called third-party innocent agent to explain why we can't just blame the Iraqis who have murdered the U.S. troops. How is it that we come to blame the president for murdering the U.S. troops?
Well, the innocent agent doctrine has been on the law, on the law books for many years, and it simply provides that if someone deliberately sets in motion a chain of events which he knows will cause, that's the key word, cause a third-party innocent agent to commit an act, then the principal is guilty of that act. Here, when George Bush invaded Iraq, he absolutely knew, unless he was planning a war without casualties, that Iraqi resistance would cause the death of American soldiers. I was talking to Cindy Sheehan. She called me this past Sunday, and these are her words, and she didn't know anything about the doctrine of innocent agents. She hadn't read that part of the book yet. She was reading the book. She hadn't gotten up to it. And she said words, I don't have them right in front of me, but words to this effect, this is almost an exact paraphrase of her. She said, the Iraqi insurgents did not kill my son, George Bush did. They were merely repelling an invader, which they had every right to do. The innocent agent doctrine has been on the books for years. Federally, it provides Section 18 of the U.S. Code, 2B, or Title 18, 2B, that if someone causes an act to be done, which if he had done it himself would make him a criminal, he cannot escape criminal responsibility by having someone else do it. Basically, what we're talking about is something analogous to a person causing a gun to fire a bullet, which kills someone, by pulling the trigger. And the person cannot make the argument, well, my co-conspirator did not kill the victim, the gun did. Bush set in motion something that he absolutely knew would cause American soldiers to die, so therefore, under the law, he's responsible for that act. It's called the innocent agent doctrine. Now, the only way he can escape liability for it would be if he took this nation to war honestly, sincerely believing that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. Then the innocent agent doctrine would not apply. But if he took this nation to war under false pretenses, as I prove in the book, then all of the killings of American soldiers in Iraq would become unlawful killings and therefore murder. And that's where we get into the evidence against him, showing that he did not take this nation to war because he thought Hussein was an imminent threat. He knew Hussein was not an imminent threat. He was told that he was not. And it's all about false pretenses. And I've got very, very powerful evidence of that fact.
I think, in fact, your book lays out the case as well or better than any I've seen. But it is this is something that we actually have a strong majority of American opinion on, that the president lied us into this war. What I don't think we have is anywhere near majority awareness of the idea that we can pin him down with a murder charge.
Well, there has not been that allegation yet, and why I'm the first one to do it, I really don't know. I imagine that my background as a prosecutor, you know, I've successfully prosecuted 21 murder cases without a loss. That may have played something to do with it. But there's other prosecutors out there, too. No one has talked about this, to my knowledge, before me. But that really is not the relevant point. The only relevant point is what I'm saying. Does it have merit or does not have merit? The fact that no one has talked about it before is not relevant. What I have heard before my book is people talking about George Bush should be prosecuted as a war criminal at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. I've heard of that several times.
Sure.
What they probably don't know is that the ICC would not have jurisdiction to prosecute Bush because the United States was not a signatory nation to the formation of the ICC in Rome in 2002. So therefore, the ICC has no jurisdiction to prosecute Bush. Bush, if at all, can only be prosecuted in an American courtroom, and I want to see a jury decide whether or not he's guilty of murder. And if they decide he is guilty of murder, then it'll be up to them to determine the appropriate punishment. One of their options, of course, being the imposition of the death penalty. The other options being life imprisonment and life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. But I think I have a fairly good record as a prosecutor, and I think I have a certain amount of credibility in the area of the criminal law. And I want your audience to know that I would not throw this out the window at this stage of my life. At my age, I don't have time for fanciful reveries. I would never in a million years talk about or propose the prosecution of George Bush for murder unless I felt that I had all the evidence that I needed and that I was standing on very strong legal ground.
Now, you mentioned an international court, and there are those who argue that an international court could bring charges even though the United States unsigned the treaty. And there are others who push for the prosecution from a foreign nation, not an international court, but some
right.
foreign nation, in the way that Israel got Eichmann, in the way that
right.
that Spain went after Pinochet, etc. There are others who push for, and this is hoping and dreaming that we have an attorney general who would do it, but federal prosecution in the United States. Are you familiar with your fellow former prosecutor Elizabeth De La Vega's book on the U.S.?
Yes, I am, but I do not believe she's talking about murder. She was talking about his lying to Congress. And,
she's talking about
and
fraud,
torture,
which
too.
Is a whole different,
right.
whole different
but,
charge.
But not murder. You know,
not murder.
Murder.
No.
Yeah. No, I respect her and her book, but she's talking about fraud, and what I'm talking about is murder. So the charges are quite different. But I have looked at her book, and it's a very good book. But I believe he should be prosecuted for murder. And fraud, of course, is a part of why he's guilty of murder. But just to prosecute him for fraud, that would be, I think, for what he did, inadequate punishment. So I do mention in the book that he can be prosecuted, I think, for fraud and torture and stuff like that. Not whether or not it could be done successfully or not, I don't know. On the issue of torture, Bush did issue a presidential directive, I think, in February of 2002, mandating that all detainees be treated humanely. That doesn't mean that he wasn't involved in the rather limited torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. I said rather limited because in war crimes trials, they're usually for genocide or mass torture. I don't know if the torture at these two places was sufficient, would be sufficient for a war crimes trial, but even if it were, there's the problem of his complicity on the torture.
Well, that memo, that directive from the president, February 7th, 2002, actually said that the Geneva Conventions will not apply to so-called enemy combatants. And then he said some muddled, nonsensical, self-contradictory stuff about
right.
humane treatment, although not applying the Geneva Conventions. And so there was some nonsense in there. But the main thrust, I think there's pretty general consensus on, was to throw out the Geneva Conventions on prisoners of war. And,
right.
and that set the torture in motion. Am I mistaken?
No, I think you're correct. It's just that when we're talking about someone responsible for a minimum of over 100,000 deaths, you see, the deaths in Iraq, he's guilty of those murders too, but we would not have any jurisdiction to prosecute him for them, only a jurisdiction to prosecute him for the 4,000 murders. But someone, and when I use the 100,000 figure, I'm talking about over 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, children, and babies who have died horrible deaths because of George Bush. For someone responsible for murder on a grand scale like that, to talk about prosecuting him for torture at these two prisons, I just don't see it. I wouldn't have time for that. I'm sure other people do, and I'm happy for them that they devote that time, but I only have time to go after someone responsible for an enormous number of murders and possibly pay the ultimate penalty if a jury convicts him.
Well, I think it's a positive sign for all of us that there is such energy and creativity out there that everybody's proposing a different way to prosecute this guy. But let's talk about the way that you've got, because ideally I would love to get him on the toughest charge, which is murder. And you argue this theory that I think we've touched on that you call vicarious liability rule of conspiracy. But then you also say that you could get him on aiding and abetting. How does that work?
Well, it's a separate, independent legal doctrine. If someone instigates the killing of someone, or in the disjunctive, assists someone in the commission of the killing, he is guilty. Here, Bush did not assist anyone in the killing of American soldiers, but he certainly instigated the killings of American soldiers in Iraq by invading Iraq. So that's a separate, independent legal theory of Bush being guilty of murder. He instigated the killings in Iraq by invading Iraq. Again, if he could show that the invasion was in good faith, and the reason he invaded Iraq is he thought Bush was an imminent threat to the security of this country, then he would be not guilty. There are several legal complexities in this case, which I discuss in depth in the book. Some of them are rather arcane, but I can tell you from my experience as a prosecutor that the central overriding legal issue at George Bush's trial was whether or not he took this nation to war in self-defense, his so-called preemptive strike. Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and therefore was an imminent threat to the security of this country, so Bush had to strike first in self-defense. If he could prove that, then the verdict should be not guilty. In fact, he shouldn't have even been prosecuted. But if the prosecutor can prove that he took this nation to war under false pretenses, on a lie, then, as I indicated earlier, all of the killings in Iraq of American soldiers would be unlawful killings and therefore murdered. So it comes down to the evidence. What does the evidence show? As it does in all criminal trials. What does the evidence show?
Well, you suggest in the book that at least in some people's mind, an issue that's likely to arise is the question of so-called malice aforethought. And you sort of correct some misunderstandings of what that should mean and argue that it does apply in this case. And you give some examples.
Yeah, you're getting into some of the legal sophistications, which I would try to avoid talking to lay people because I go into depth, but that's in the book on it. Well, malice aforethought, there can be two types of malice aforethought. One is express malice, that's a specific intent to kill. And the other type is implied malice, which is the intent to do a very dangerous act with reckless disregard for the consequences. Here on the intention to kill, we're getting into sophistications here, Dave, which is fine if you want it. Bush arguably did not specifically intend to kill American soldiers. However, you could make this argument. Is there any difference between A, intending to kill B, or not intending to kill B, but intending to do an act which will kill B? In the law, it's called a distinction without substance. Also, we get into the notion that under the law, people are presumed to intend the natural consequences of their act. And certainly the natural consequences of Bush invading Iraq is that American soldiers are going to be killed. I'm trying to capsulize all this. I get into much more depth on it in the book. So the issue is whether it's first-degree murder or second-degree murder. In many states, there doesn't have to be an intent to kill to constitute first-degree murder because there are no degrees of murder. Texas is an example. So in that state, we wouldn't even get into the issue of whether he intended to kill. His merely intending to do an act with reckless disregard for the consequences and indifference to human life, which at a minimum we have here in going to war, would enable any prosecutor to convict him of murder. And in Texas, convicted of murder, they don't get into first or second, he could get the death penalty. But we're getting into things that are highly legal. I'm not sure we're going to make that much progress. We can talk more and more about the legality. Is your show a show that's listened to mostly by lawyers, David, or not?
Oh, absolutely not. But let me tell you why I bring it up, because you have some very interesting examples in the book, and you talk about the felony murder rule, where if you happen to accidentally kill somebody.
Right.
I'm sorry?
No, I said you're getting into more sophisticated. Okay, yeah.
Well,
the felony murder.
If you hang on 10 seconds, I'll explain why I'm bringing this up.
And I certainly don't think I'm going
over the heads of any listeners, but they will tell us if I am. We'll have people with written questions and phoning in. So, you describe, for example, someone's robbing a store, and the owner of the store in defense shoots a bullet and accidentally kills a bystander, and the person who was robbing the store is convicted of murder who wasn't even anywhere near the weapon because they were committing a felony. And this is where I think what Elizabeth de la Vega has done helps what you're doing, and your case might be even stronger. And tell me if I'm wrong, because maybe I'm nuts and I'm not a lawyer. But when Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq and shock and awe, and when, as required by Congress, he sent them this letter and this report claiming that Iraq was an imminent threat and making all of these patently false statements, in doing that, he was committing a number of felonies. He was violating the federal anti-conspiracy statute. He was violating the False Statements Accountability Act of 96, and so forth. Does that help the prosecution?
Okay. One thing, and I'm not dropping names here, but Johnny Carson told me once, Vince, I read all of your endnotes, because I have a lot of endnotes in my book. You know, Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, it's my most recent book prior to this one.
Yes.
It has a CD attached with 1,000 pages in it, and these are long endnotes. I think in one of the endnotes I mentioned in someone in the book, I think it's in an endnote, where I mentioned that the felony murder rule would not apply here because what you're just talking about there, the conspiracy, et cetera, that's not one of the enumerated felonies for the felony murder rule to apply under Section 1111 of Title 18 of the United States Code. It's only when certain felonies are committed. Certain enumerated felonies. The most prominent felony by far that the felony murder rule is applied to is robbery. But there are other crimes like burglary, rape, etc. But not the felony that you mentioned, the conspiracy.
Not those ones.
No. But that's in an endnote. Did you read all the endnotes of the book or not? You probably did.
I do not recall.
Most people don't read endnotes.
Most people don't, for some reason.
They feel it's an endnote if not important.
I certainly didn't, so you can lump me in with the rest of those people.
99 out of 100 people don't read endnotes, but when I write a book like this, I know that lawyers are going to be putting it under a high-powered microscope, certainly conservative lawyers, so I'm preparing for their assaults on the legal accuracy of my book, so many of the legal discussions are in the endnotes, and that's one of them right there. I'm 99% sure it's in an endnote. The crime that you're talking about is not an enumerated felony that would allow the felony murder rule to come into play.
That's an excellent thing to know. I highly recommend to everyone that you do get a copy of the book and read the whole book and the end notes. It's The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder by our guest Vincent Bugliosi. And if you want to get in on this conversation with your questions now, this evening, call in toll-free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. If you are outside the U.S. or Canada, 877-489-6350. Or send us your questions in the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. You seem eager to talk about the evidence, and I've been tired of it for years, but maybe most of our listeners have not. And you lay it out in a new and compelling way in your book. Why don't you tell us what the evidence is?
Okay, well, I present much evidence in the book of Bush's guilt. These are just a couple pieces. We're not going to go over all of the evidence, obviously, but one very big piece of evidence against Bush, and by the way, David, the evidence that I'll be talking about here briefly is the same evidence that prompted, I think this will be interesting to your audience, prompted a very conservative Southern Republican congressman who voted for the war, was one of its most vocal supporters, to call me at my home on June 16th. And say that after he listened to the audio tape of my book, he's now convinced that Bush deliberately misled Congress into war. He said he bought several copies of the book to give to his colleagues in Congress, telling them we've been lied to, read the book, and he proposed a conference call with me and himself and several others this coming month to decide where to go from here. But this is a very conservative Southern Republican congressman.
I'm guessing Walter Jones. Can I guess Walter Jones?
Well, I'm not going to. I don't think he... I never really asked him specifically, can I use your name? At some point, I will. But I will say he's running for re-election, and he may not want his name out there. John Conyers, I can say, he called me a couple days ago. He's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. People are reading my book in Congress. So I'm not seeking these people out because there's nothing that Congress can do. I am seeking prosecutors out. They can prosecute him. Congress cannot prosecute him. They can impeach him. They can't prosecute him. But Conyers called and said he's reading the book, and he agrees with what I'm saying. He's excited about the book, and he wants to help out. In George Bush's first speech to the nation, David, on Hussein in Iraq on October 7th, 2002, from Cincinnati, Ohio, he told the American people that Hussein was a great danger to our nation, either by Hussein attacking us with weapons of mass destruction or by giving these weapons to a terrorist group to attack us. And he said that this attack could happen, quote, on any given day, unquote, meaning the threat was imminent. The only big problem for Bush is that on October the 1st, just 6 days earlier, the CIA sent Bush its 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, a classified, top-secret report that represented the consensus opinion of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA, on the issue of whether or not Hussein was an imminent threat. And on page 8 of the 91-page report, it clearly and unequivocally says, and by the way, what I'm about to tell your audience, to my knowledge, has never appeared in any major newspaper or magazine in America. Why? I do not know. The report clearly says that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country, that he would only be a threat to us. As it turns out, he would, even under these conditions, he would not. As you know, he disposed of his weapons of mass destruction way back in 1991 at the end of the Persian Gulf War. But from their perspective, the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies said he would only be a threat to us if he feared that America was about to attack him. In other words, Hussein would only be a threat if he was forced to fight in self-defense. So we know then, not think, but know, that when Bush told the nation on the evening of October 7, 2002, that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, he was telling millions of unsuspecting Americans the exact opposite of what his own CIA was telling him. And it gets worse. On October 4th, just 3 days after the October 1st, 2002 classified report, Bush and his people had the CIA issue an unclassified summary version of the classified report so they could release this unclassified version to Congress and the American people. And this unclassified version, David, came to be known as the White Paper. And in this white paper that was shown to Congress and the American people, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence that Iraq was not an imminent threat to the security of this country was completely deleted. I have it right on my desk here, the report. Every single one of these all-important words were taken out. And my question is, how evil, how perverse, how sick, how criminal can Bush and his people be? Yet unbelievably, and there's no other word for it, up to this point, they've gotten away with all of this, and over 100,000 precious human beings are in their cold graves right now, David, as I'm talking to you, because of it. There's another very strong piece of evidence, and it comes right out of George Bush's own mouth. You're aware of the Downing Street memo. That got a lot of attention, mentioned in many newspapers and many magazine articles and many books. I'm not going to get into the Downing Street memo. It's in my book, but I can just tell you that although I probably presented at the trial, it's not that impressive because no source is given and there's an ambiguity to it. If you want to spend time on it, I will, but what I'd like to talk about is a memo that received very, very, very little attention, and virtually everyone I talked to, they have no idea, they don't know anything about the memo. It's called the Manning Memo. It's much, much more important than the Downing Street Memo. The Manning Memo is comes out of a January 31st, 2003 meeting that Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair had in their Bush's Oval Office with six of their top aides, including Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, David Manning. After the meeting, Manning prepared a five-page memo stamped, quote, extremely sensitive, unquote, summarizing what was said at the meeting. And he wrote that Bush and Blair expressed their doubts that any weapons of mass destruction would ever be found in Iraq before they invaded Iraq, which was bad, but it gets much, much, much worse. He wrote that Bush, not Blair, but he said that Bush was so worried about the failure of the UN inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that he talked about three possible ways, Manning wrote, to, quote, provoke a confrontation, unquote, with Hussein, one of which, Bush said, was to, quote, fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq, falsely painted in United Nations colors. And Bush said if Hussein fired on them, he would be in violation of UN resolutions, and that would justify our going to war. So Bush is telling the American people, telling the world, that Hussein is an imminent threat to the security of this country, so we had to strike first in self-defense. But behind closed doors, this small man, George Bush, was talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. The last person in the world whom someone acting legitimately and honestly in self-defense would try to provoke is the person, obviously, he's in deathly fear of, the person who's about to kill him. And if Bush actually and honestly believed that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, which was his main basis, he said, for going to war, the thought of provoking Hussein into a war, by definition, would never, ever, ever have entered his mind. I was on a talk show with Dennis Miller about a week and a half ago, and Dennis fell hopelessly in love with the Republican Party at the time of 9/11, and I discuss Dennis's silliness in the book. In any event, I was telling Dennis about the Manning memo, and I said, Dennis, let's assume that you're defending George Bush, and I call Manning to the witness stand to testify to what your client said on January 31st, 2003 in the Oval Office. And I said, Dennis, other than trying to hide beneath the console table, how would you respond to David Manning and the Manning memo? And Dennis is very swift, and he's bright, and he said, I'd ask for a recess. Well, no matter how long that recess took, whether it's 1 hour or a day or a week or a month or a year, it wouldn't make any difference because there is no response to the Manning memo other than guilt. These are two very important pieces of evidence. I have much more in the book, of course.
Needless to say, there's unlimited, overwhelmingly redundant evidence, but I couldn't agree with you more that these are some of the strongest pieces. And of course, after Bush and Blair finished this meeting, at which Bush was proposing wild and criminal and almost comedic plots to instigate a war, they went out and talked to the press about how they were striving for peace and working hard to avoid war and had made no decisions to go to war. And those reporters now know about this memo and have never gone back and said, why did you lie to us like that? We have to take a few minute break for commercials and messages and important information. This is David Swanson, your host at thepeoplespeakradio.net. Our guest is Vincent Bugliosi, author of The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. You can learn more at prosecutionofbush.com and get a copy of this book and get a copy for everybody you know. For the Downing Street memos, go to my website, afterdowningstreet.org. For the Manning memo, which we always call the White House memo, go to afterdowningstreet.org/White House memo. We will be back in a few.
This land
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. Economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This land is your land. This land is mine.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. Send in your questions at thepeoplespeakradio.net. Call in toll free at 888-228-4494. Outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. This is David Swanson, and our guest for the rest of the hour is Vincent Bugliosi, one of the best prosecutors our country has seen, and authors, and the author of, most recently, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. I've got a lot of questions, but we've got questions coming in through the chat room. Scott in Canada asks, given that Congress gave permission to go to war, is not the real responsibility on Congress, and should you not be prosecuting them for negligence and not vetting out the information?
Well, negligence is not a crime. Now we're getting sophistications. There is such a thing as criminal negligence, which will only give you a verdict of involuntary manslaughter. I'm talking about murder and possibly the death penalty. So negligence, Scott, is not a crime. Now you raised a good issue. October the 11th, 2002, Congress authorized Bush to go to war, but it's boilerplate law that fraud vitiates consent. Vitiates is a legal term meaning negates. Fraud negates consent. A consent induced by fraud is no good. And like I told you, the Southern congressman said that after reading the book, he agreed and believes that Bush deliberately misled Congress into war. Remember, I was telling you about the October 4th white paper, which was only 7 days before Congress authorized Bush to go to war. 7 days before. And in that October 4th white paper, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence that Hussein was not an imminent threat was completely deleted. That shows that Congress was also deceived. I can tell you this also. The conclusion of 16 U.S. intelligence agencies that Hussein might have weapons of mass destruction. They stated it as their opinion was converted in the white paper into a fact, not that they believed or assessed that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, but that Hussein did have. Also, there were several prominent dissents in the classified document, the October 1st classified document. The October 4th document that was shown to Congress and American people, all of those dissents were deleted. So, long answer to your question, Scott, yes, they gave him consent to go to war, but that consent was based on fraud. Are they guilty of a crime? No, negligence, for all intents and purposes. Unless you want to talk about involuntary manslaughter, which I'm not going to devote one more second to, negligence, laziness, sloth, incompetence, what have you, is not a crime. They had no criminal intent.
Well, I understand the sentiments, at least, of the questioner, as I'm sure you do, and I think aside from the bizarrely unconstitutional way that they let the president take us into this thing, their funding of it for years and years, long since having known what a fraud and crime it was, is at least morally reprehensible. But let's get to this serious question, because a lot of people who listen to this show are activists. They're involved. They want to do something. And I'm very curious what people can do to track down the best, or elect the best local or state prosecutors and pair them up with the best Gold Star families, and whether you've heard from anybody yet. Having offered your assistance in the book, have you heard from any prosecutors or any Gold Star families other than Cindy Sheehan who want to take this up and make it happen?
Okay, let me talk about jurisdiction for a moment. If someone were to ask me what's the likelihood of Bush being prosecuted for murder, I would say there's not a high probability of it, but I definitely believe there's a substantial possibility that George Bush will end up in court being prosecuted for murder. The main reason I say that is because of the jurisdiction that I've established in the book for such a great number of prosecutors. Federally, there's really only one prosecutor. I'm not going to get into the whole story, but basically only one, the U.S. Attorney General, Washington, D.C., acting through his Department of Justice. There are 93 U.S. attorneys around the country. They're not going to do it without the consent of their boss in Washington. So there's really only one prosecutor on a federal basis. However, on a state level, I've established jurisdiction for the Attorney General in each of the 50 states, plus about 950 district attorneys in counties within those states to prosecute Bush for the murder of any soldier or soldiers from their state or county who were killed fighting George Bush's war in Iraq. Now, with all those prosecutors out there, about 1,000 prosecutors, and with all the evidence of guilt that I set forth against Bush in my book, I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that at least one prosecutor out there, maybe many more, will be courageous enough to step forward and say, hey, this is the United States of America, and in America, no man is above the law, the evidence of Bush's guilt is clear, and I'm going to go after him to bring about justice for the American people. In a matter of about 4 or 5 days, I will be sending out a copy of my book, plus a cover letter from me, to each of the 50 attorney generals in this country, asking them to read the book. And if they agree with me that the evidence of Bush's guilt is clear and there's jurisdiction to proceed against Bush, and I'm offering my services, as you indicated, David, in any way that they see fit, which would include being a consultant all the way up to and including being appointed a special prosecutor. But the books have not gone out yet. I don't know how many read the book at this point. The book just came out about 4 weeks ago. It's already, as I say, on the New York Times bestseller list, although it's being completely blacked out by the major media. But I can tell you this. I heard about a week ago that possibly in a week and a half or two from now, they're making the arrangements in a major eastern city. The parents of a young man who was killed in Iraq are going to be going in to see the DA of that county, who's going to be provided with a copy of my book. I'm not sending it to this DA. These are other people that are furnishing the DA with a copy of my book. And these parents are going to say, in effect, that if the DA agrees with what I say in the book, they're going to ask this DA, these parents, are going to ask him. They don't have any control over him or any authority over him, but they're going to ask him to prosecute George Bush for murder. I can tell you the story of a lawyer back east who called me on the phone about 2 weeks ago, and these are things that are happening in this country, and you can extrapolate from them. And he said, "Vince, I'm a big fan of yours, telling everyone to read the book. He said, I want you to know that no one in my county yet has died in the war, but if one does, he said, I'm going to run for district attorney. I'm going to become a politician. Run for DA, and if I become DA, I'm going to prosecute George Bush for murder." You have to realize there's no statute of limitations for murder. You know, they went after Pinochet in Chile 33 years later, and then he ended up dying, which aborted the prosecution. We take the phone. They fax things so we don't hear that sound. This is a very real thing here. This is a very real thing, and it could happen. Whether it's going to happen, I don't know, but don't assume that Bush is not going to end up being prosecuted for murder. No one has set forth the legal architecture in the case against him. There's been no book out there that has done that before this. There's something else I'd like to talk about, David, because I think it's important in my book, and it really served as one of the strongest emotional underpinnings for the book. The fact that throughout the hell on earth George Bush created in Iraq, with over 100,000 people dying horrible, violent deaths, and hundreds of thousands of their survivors crying out hysterically and having nightmares over what happened to their loved ones. This man, George Bush, and the evidence is overwhelming, I present much of it in the book, has smiled through it all. In fact, if you look at a photo of Bush and six or seven other people all smiling, who has the biggest smile on his face? George Bush. The evidence is very clear that while young American soldiers, you know, some of them 18, 19-year-old kids who never had a chance to live out their dreams, while they were being blown to pieces by roadside bombs in Iraq, George Bush was having fun and enjoying life to the fullest, running, bicycling, joking with friends, slapping backs, dancing and swiveling his hips like Elvis to blaring music, almost always appearing to be in the very best of good spirits. And I tell your audience, they don't have to take my word for this or the photo section of my book, which shows Bush just having a ball. Bush himself has had no hesitancy at all in saying things like this over and over again. And while I'm quoting Bush, I would ask you and your audience, try to imagine in your wildest imagination presidents like Roosevelt, Truman, LBJ, Nixon, saying things like this during their respective wars. And also try to imagine in your mind the reality that while Bush is saying these things, all of the horror and the screams and the sea of blood are going on in Iraq at the time he's saying things like this. Here's Bush. "Laura and I are having the time of our lives. I'm in a great mood. It's a perfect day. I'm feeling pretty good about life." David, even if George Bush was only guilty of making an innocent mistake and taking this nation to war in Iraq, not murder, as I firmly believe, with all of the death, horror, and suffering he has caused, what type of a monstrous individual is it who could be happy?
Well, he's the son of a woman who said, "Why should I bother my beautiful mind with such things?" I think your book for this analysis of Bush's attitude alone is worth the price of buy-in, and I think for your analysis of the absurdity of 9/11, of taking this outrageous negligence that allows this attack to happen and turning it into a positive thing. What a great president to be president and allow us to be attacked. For that analysis alone, it's worth buying. We have a caller on the line that I'd love to get in on the last 5 minutes of this conversation.
Okay.
Rain from Richmond, Virginia, do you have a question for Vince Bugliosi?
I do. I have high praise first. My question, I read the interview or report back from Linda Milazzo, who sat down with you, and she said that you were really unaware of how many people already were out here wanting impeachment and the blogosphere and how important it was. And well, anyway, so we're all here, and we're so glad you came. How has that affected your optimism for your project?
Well, just last night, I spoke to about 350 Democratic activists at a church in Venice, California. And when I got up there, I was stunned. They gave me a standing ovation for about 3 minutes before I even said a word. And it's going to be on, my speech is going to be on, it was televised last night on, this is embarrassing, C-SPAN. I'm certainly aware of C-SPAN. And I think they're going to show it, all 2.5 hours of it, over the weekend. Why Linda was saying this is that I live like a hermit. You know, I work 7 days a week. I don't have a computer. I don't have a cell phone. And I'm still in the 19th century with a yellow pad and pencil. And Linda was telling me there's a lot of people out there that are supporting you tremendously. Not for the impeachment thing, but that's what they were thinking about before, but going after this man and making him really pay for his terrible, terrible crimes. Obviously, George Bush should be impeached. I don't talk about that in the book hardly at all. Why? I'll tell you why. Because in America, apparently we impeach presidents for having consensual sex outside of marriage and trying to cover it up. Now, if we impeach presidents for that, then when you take the nation to war under false pretenses and over 100,000 people end up in their graves, obviously the punishment has got to be much, much more severe than impeachment. If Bush were impeached, convicted in the Senate, and removed from office, he'd still be a free man. Still be able to get up in the morning with his cup of coffee, freshly squeezed orange juice, read the morning paper, still be able to lead a life of privilege, travel widely, belong to the country club, get standing ovations, talking about standing ovations from the Republican faithful when you decide to speak to them. And my question is this. Does anyone really believe that George Bush should be permitted to lead this type of life, which would follow from impeachment?
No, not a single impeachment activist believes that. What they believe is that if we don't impeach him, we're telling the next president, it's okay with us, it's okay with our representatives in our so-called House of Representatives to go ahead and do that. Whereas if he's impeached, then he cannot, in a court of law, say as his defense, well, my people, my subjects, never impeached me.
I'm not questioning the fact that he should be impeached. Obviously, it's too self-evident to state. He should be impeached. I'm simply saying that impeachment alone, if you're interested in true justice, impeachment alone would be a joke in this case. But obviously, he should be impeached for all the reasons that you said. But
yeah,
I believe he could suffer a lot more than impeachment.
Yeah, I've not met a single impeachment advocate who doesn't want him behind bars as well.
Right.
It's a question of doing both, and the thinking in most people's minds is that they work together, they help each other, and if we get one,
all they talk about is impeachment, though.
Well, no, maybe some people
other than
do.
The war crimes thing, I have no one, not boasting or anything, no one talked about prosecuting this guy in a court of law, American prosecutor in front of an American jury, for murder. And why I don't know.
Well, we're going to buy you a computer, and you're going to go to my website, convictbushcheney.org, where we have been organizing people, dozens of people have been buying copies of your book and sending them to prosecutors and sending them to law professors.
That's wonderful.
People are extremely excited about it, and we've got about 2 minutes left, but I just want to touch on a detail because it's come up repeatedly on the show. Every serious study I've seen now places the death count above and beyond what it was under the sanctions at over 1 million. And yet I didn't read the end notes, but without any reference, you cite repeatedly 100,000. Seems wildly...
In the end notes, I talk about all the various studies, one of which is over 1 million. Now, that's all in the end notes. I'm being extremely conservative, you're right, but I have all the studies in an end note, one of which places the number of casualties over 1 million. That was an estimate where they interviewed a certain number, like 1,000 Iraqi families, and asked them the question, did any member of your family die in the war so far? And based on those answers, by extrapolation, they came up with over 1 million, and that was about a year and a half ago. There have been other estimates placing the number at 650,000. The most conservative estimate is 150,000 as of about a year ago. So I'm being very, very conservative when I say over 100,000. But that's all in an end note. Got to read the end note.
Well, the Johns Hopkins Lancet study that was 650,000 updated to the present is well over a million, and a couple of serious studies done by British research are also
right.
over a million. In fact,
right.
each study that's been done with any sort of seriousness is over a million. So I would...
I haven't seen that. I've seen one study over a million, and the others, probably by extrapolation, by now it would be over a million, but all the others that I've seen were below a million, 650,000.
Well, in any case, it can only strengthen your case, and the case is overwhelmingly well-made already, and I cannot recommend this book more highly, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder by Vincent Bugliosi. Mr. Bugliosi, thank you so much for your time and for everything you're doing.
David, thank you for having me on the show, and I want to compliment you for doing your homework. You worked hard, you came up with some very good questions, and so often I'm on a show and the person has not done their homework, and you did, and I want to compliment you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much for your time. And this is The People Speak Radio. We are at thepeoplespeakradio.net. We live and breathe on your generous contributions. Go there and give us your money. And get ready for Monday night with former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, and be prepared for Tuesday, July 8th with John Dean, member of the Nixon administration who has a new book, but whose favorite book of mine remains Worse Than Watergate, which is where we are, folks. We are in a situation far worse than Watergate. ThePeopleSpeakRadio.net. Speak with you again next time.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the stable, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah.